Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening in to this recording of a conversation that we're having between. My name is Tim Judson. I'm the executive director at Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and I had the pleasure of being joined by Professor Ben Sovacool. He's a professor at Aarhus University in Denmark and at the Vermont Law School. He is a widely published author, including books called "The Contesting the Future of Nuclear Power and Climate Change and Global Energy Security." And his research really focuses on issues of renewable energy and energy efficiency, the politics of energy infrastructure, improving energy security and access to electricity, and adapting to the consequences of climate change. So, Ben, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
It's my pleasure, Tim.
Great. So just wanted to kick off with some questions here. Ben, you've done a lot of technical research on nuclear energy and on the climate crisis. Could you start by sharing your thoughts on priority action society should take to address the climate crisis, and where should we be investing our time and money now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, of course, lots of energy analysts, policymakers, even students around the world kind of are asking this question every day. And, of course, there's no one-size-fits-all solution. What works in Alabama may not work in Azerbaijan, et cetera. But I think most research already tends to tell us what some of the answers are. And I think the single most effective solution, regardless of where you are, in developing Asia, in North America, in Europe, is energy efficiency. And there have been study after study, and many of them independent, not done by think tanks like ACEEE or the Alliance to Save Energy, which are kind of advocates of energy efficiency. But we're talking about the International Energy Agency or the U.S. Department of Energy or peer-reviewed scholars at Cambridge University or Oxford University. And I've seen dozens and dozens of these studies that suggest the cheapest source of energy by far, better than renewables, better than nuclear power, better than shale gas, better than clean coal, is demand-side management and improvements in efficiency through things like fuel economy standards for vehicles, appliance standards for your refrigerator, or phase-outs of things like the incandescent light bulb. Overall, these types of programs tend to save electricity at about 2 to 3 cents per kilowatt hour. And anybody who's recently paid their electricity bill in the U.S. knows that they pay 10 to 13 cents per kilowatt hour. And anybody that works for a utility will tell you the cheapest power they can generate is about 5 to 7 cents per kilowatt hour when you include all the costs involved in transmission, distribution, et cetera. Right? So energy efficiency is half that at 3 cents. And that's the average spread across many programs and countries. When you get into specific programs, you can go as low as half a cent. Right? And so as I often say, the cheapest power plant is often the one you never have to build.
That's great. And so your book, Contesting the Future of Nuclear Power, I mean, it's been a huge contribution, and we really want to thank you for writing that. But if you could, can you boil it down to what you see as the relationship between nuclear energy and the climate crisis, especially given the economics that you just described?
Yeah, and I think that my book, Contesting the Future of Nuclear Power, wasn't necessarily about why nuclear power has no role. It's very critical of nuclear power for a variety of reasons, not just climate, right? You've got the accident issue, you have cost overruns, you have the nuclear weapons and proliferation issue. But really what it was about was you have an array of options that you can use, modern society can use to mitigate emissions, promote energy security. And nuclear, for better or for worse, kind of falls in the middle. You have those technologies like coal and oil, which I think no doubt are dirtier and more harmful, at least now, compared to nuclear energy. I'm not talking about the nuclear waste issue because who knows what's going to happen over the next, 100, 200,000 years. But at least right now, like most people, if I had to choose between coal and oil and nuclear, I might seriously consider nuclear. However, the book contests that claim because it says that's a false debate. It's not just about fossil fuels and nuclear. It's also about energy efficiency and renewable energy. And the book tries to make the case that, in fact, every single source of renewable electricity, even solar PV, but also hydro, geothermal, biomass, wind, and yes, efficiency, can beat nuclear power with almost any way you do the evaluation, based on cost, based on emissions, based on risk, based on accidents, based on decommissioning, based on rapid ability to scale up, mitigation techniques based on adaptability to local regulatory frameworks, right? Based on waste, based on pollution, based on life cycle assessment, all of those things, nuclear power tends to score worse than the renewables. And so it was kind of an attempt to kind of refocus the debate and say, you know, it's not just nuclear, big nuclear and big fossil fuels, it's also renewables. And I think many people now, after Fukushima, and after they've kind of seen the kind of death of the nuclear renaissance, are kind of starting to see that as well.
So, I mean, who do you think really benefits from continuing the conversation about, you know, creating a big role for nuclear, you know, in addressing climate change and in our energy future?
Well, I think it does have a role to play, but I think the big a role to play in most countries, most industrialized countries. I don't think it has much of a role to play in emerging economies. And if you're even talking about a nuclear plant for places like Bangladesh or Ghana or Ethiopia, I mean, it's laughable. Nuclear power is so expensive, even in the U.S., that building a single new nuclear power plant, it requires almost as much capitalization as some of the biggest utilities have, like Exelon. They could only afford to do one or two, and that's the biggest of the big, right? So when you talk about Nepal Electricity Authority, right, or TANESCO in Tanzania, they can't even think about nuclear power. So that's one of the first problems, is that nuclear power kind of shuts out a whole large segment of countries that need energy. So who does it benefit? Well, that kind of points you to the answer. It benefits industrialized countries like France or the U.S. that have large manufacturing centers for nuclear components or technology. And I mean, the number of countries that can make the stuff today is kind of short. It's France, which is huge. It's the United States. It's South Korea. It's Japan. And then it's a few of the kind of newcomers that are trying to kind of create their indigenous reactors. This is China, you know, or India, and some like South Africa that are still doing research, ESCOM, on things like pebble bed modular reactors. So really, though, I think that you have kind of three groups of predominant people that the nuclear discussion benefits. The first are simply the companies that are making this stuff. So that's companies like GE or Areva, Mitsubishi, Westinghouse. The second group are large-scale centralized utilities. And right now, many people may not be aware that the traditional utility model is under attack because homes are consuming a lot less energy, especially smart homes. People are becoming somewhat more conscious about household electricity consumption, right, because it's starting to cost more. And so you've actually seen in both Europe and North America declining sales of electricity and thus declining profits. And so these large-scale utility companies are looking for ways to anchor their business model. And the nice thing about a nuclear plant is if you build it, right, you have to spend 30 years paying it off. And so you're able to wed your ratepayers and your system to that model. And so I think that's a second kind of area of these large-scale utilities like Exelon and Southern Company and Georgia Power that want to maintain Duke Energy, want to maintain control. And nuclear is the way that they do that. I think the final stakeholder is the most interesting, and these are a kind of small but very vocal part of the environmental community that sees nuclear power as the single solution to climate change. This is James Lovelock. This is James Hansen. This is those who mean well, the Breakthrough Institute. But they really think it is a battle to save the climate, and they think for whatever reason that nuclear power is the only answer, and they won't even consider nuclear renewables or energy efficiency, which is where I happen to disagree with them. And I think those, unlike the first two sets of stakeholders, you kind of have not sinister motives, but at least self-interested motives. I think many of the environmentalists have honestly good intentions, but I think they've kind of been misled by some savvy data and reports that the World Nuclear Association or the Nuclear Energy Agency are able to put out. And I also think that the problem is further compounded because it's very difficult to distinguish kind of good, neutral, peer-reviewed research from the kind of industry-sponsored research, which tend to be less reliable. And there have been some good studies by independent experts, like Mark Cooper, who's an economist who does a lot of great work at Vermont Law, who compare the estimates done by vendors with like the estimates done by independent scholars. And of course, the independent scholars' estimates are always much, much more critical of nuclear energy. But if you believe the industry-sponsored stuff, as many of these environmentalists do, nuclear does look good. And so I'm not surprised that many of them, even though they're smart, are kind of captured by this idea that nuclear energy can save the climate.
And how do you, I mean, what's your take on, the way in which, even people, like James Hansen will dismiss the ability of renewable energy, even, even given its emerging track record right now?
I think that they happen to just be wrong. And I think that the only thing that you can do, John Keynes once, I change my mind when the facts change. Sorry. Someone is walking into my office. Keynes said, I change my mind when the facts change. What do, sir? And I think that that's kind of the question you have to point to a lot of these advocates of nuclear energy, which is, look, it's a fundamentally different market now than it was in 2000, 2002. When people thought that the nuclear renaissance would start taking off, right? Things have changed. And I think that anybody who continues to advocate nuclear power just hasn't kind of taken or appreciated those types of changes. I mean, the only markets where nuclear power currently is, quote, taking off are markets that are heavily controlled by governments, right, China, or markets where they completely fail to account for the externalities of nuclear power, like in India. Right, where they have all these types of subsidies. The private market, right, venture capital, has not invested in nuclear energy. They haven't invested for quite some time, and that tells you something. It's because it's an incredibly large risk. It's, as Peter Bradford, who used to be head of the NRC, once said, a nuclear reactor is the only thing he knows of where a billion-dollar asset can become a trillion-dollar liability in a matter of hours. Right, and so no one wants to take that risk. You either build nuclear power safely, or you can build it cheaply. You can't do both, as we learned with Fukushima, or Chernobyl. So, I think that the problem with these types of advocates is that they believe it, but because they believe it, they filter out information that counters their views. And what do you do with that? I think sometimes you have to try to engage those people. But I think other times you just have to write them off. You have to say, no matter what you show them, no matter what studies you give them, no matter what data that you generate, they will not believe, right? Because it's almost like a religion, the nuclear religion. As I think even a few books, I forget the authors, but there are a few books that compare nuclear power to nuclearism, this kind of religion and faith that we can harness the power of the atom for good. So it is almost religious. And what do you do with religious zealots? You can't argue with them. You just have to kind of match their fervor with your own. And I think that may be depressing, but that may be what is needed. We can show them report after report, but that won't convince them. What do we have to do? We have to create greater momentum than they have somehow. And I'm just reminded, as an aside, by I went to a Jesuit school for my bachelor's degree, so unusual that religion has a role to play in all this. But I always remember this pastor at school that used to talk about why there was war instead of peace. And he said, for me, it's quite simple. The military-industrial complex, the people selling weapons, the people that are making bombs, the people that are using mercenary forces, is much larger than the peace industry. In fact, has anybody ever heard of the peace industry, apart from Greenpeace? And he says, we will always have war until we have an industry dedicated to peace that is equal or greater than that which is dedicated to war. And I think the same is true here with nuclear power. Until we have kind of a concerted effort that involves universities and think tanks and activists and companies and suppliers and manufacturers that is equal or greater than the nuclear industry, we don't really have much of a hope. And the problem with the nuclear industry is it straddles energy and defense, right? Because these reactors aren't just making, fuel. The industry isn't just making uranium for reactors that generate electricity. It's also making plutonium for bombs. And so it's fused with national security things. And I think that is maybe what's so tricky is how do you create momentum equal to that very large industry? And the new renewables industry is getting there, right? Last year, about $200 billion is the global market for all renewables, if you include big hydro. But it's just a fraction of the $1.1 trillion fossil fuel market. And the nuclear market, if you account for national defense, is also close to that, right? And so $200 billion versus $2 trillion, well, I think you can kind of see how far we have to go.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your insights on this and for taking the time to talk to us. Do you have any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
Not so much. Just that, nuclear power, one of the things that it has going for it in its favor, to be fair, it has very large capacity factors that are above 90% for the newest reactor fleet in the U.S. and it's quite affordable for plants that you've already paid off. So I think that what that means is that existing reactors, when they're regulated the way they are in places like the U.S., they aren't always perfect, but they may have some marginal role to play. But that's completely different than trying to build new reactors, right, in parts of the world that have the greatest demand for electricity, Asia and Africa. I think that there's practically little to no role that nuclear power will play for those places, and those are the places where emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, energy consumption will grow the most over the next three decades. And so as Peter Bradford joked a few months ago, the best way to kill nuclear power is to do nothing. Just let the market kind of take its role going forward for the next 5 or 10 years, and it will be marginalized no matter what. And even the IAEA has kind of seen this in some of their projections, where nuclear power grows, but it doesn't grow as quickly as everything else, and it doesn't grow as quickly as global energy consumption. And so as Amory Lovins mused, nuclear power is the technology of the future whose time may already have passed.
That's great. Well, thanks, Ben.
Oh, you're welcome, Tim.
All right. Well, have a great day.
Sorry about the person walking into my office.
No problem at all. Hopefully we all get interrupted.
You can edit that out somewhat, I hope.
Yeah, well, we might not need to, but thanks anyway.
Okay. I also tended to pontificate a little bit too longly on the war and peace stuff, but please.